So thanks for the introduction. I'll proceed according to the following outline. I'll first give you a short overview with some historical background, which is important to understand how this algorithm actually was created. Then I'll jump straight into the issues with the specific implementation of this algorithm in GSTool. We'll give you a short overview of the disclosure timeline, because there were some interesting things in there, and at the end I'll jump right into the Chiasmus cipher itself, which will probably be a little complex for everyone who isn't interested in cryptography, but very interesting for people who like to analyze and develop ciphers. So, for the introduction, I didn't do this alone. I worked in a team with Erik Teves and Julian Welde. And later we learned that this was independently discovered by Felix Schuster some time ago. And one of the issues I'm reporting here was also discovered way before by Christian Dresser and published, and we already found that during our research. About me, I studied IT security in Darmstadt, and I spent way too much time behind a keyboard, and that means I get bad ideas, and something like this usually happens when I get bad ideas. I found an SSL issue in the Ausweiser, that's why some of you might know my name, so the BSE probably doesn't like me anyways. And I would like to point out that I know applied cryptography, that means I have some idea how to implement cryptographic schemes and design around an existing cipher, but I cannot design or analyze a cipher myself. That's one of the things Erik Teves, for example, have helped me a lot. The BSI is the Bundesamt für Sicherheit in der Informationstechnik, which roughly translates to Federal Office for Information Security, and they are the ones who designed this algorithm. They emerged in 1991 from the BND crypto department, so they do have quite an idea of cryptography. First they were the Zentralstelle für das Chiffrierwesen, then in 1998 they turned into the Zentralstelle für Sicherheit in der Informationstechnik when they got some additional IT security tasks, and now they're the BSI. The BSI is designed, among others, two ciphers, which is, and one of them is the one we are talking about here. They are non-public until recently. So officially they are not published, and this is a policy decision to only use unpublished ciphers to make crypto analysis harder. This violates Kerckhoff's law, but the idea itself isn't too crazy if it's done correctly. One of the ciphers is Chiasmus, which is an algorithm meant for software implementations, and there's two programs known to be that implemented. One of them is Chiasmus for Windows and Linux, which is a file encryption software using this algorithm, and this is restricted. You cannot get it as an individual, you need to prove that you have some public interest in having it. So we weren't able to analyze that. But there's also GSTool. The GSTool is publicly available, as there's a demo version you can simply download and run. And it also implements the Chiasmus algorithm for file encryption. The second algorithm the BSE designed, which we will not talk about here, is Libelle, which is optimized and meant for hardware. It's used in the so-called Pluto chip, which is also used by the SINA boxes, which is the VPN used for lawful intercept data captured. Like, if the government steals your emails, that's what they'll encrypt it so no one else steals them. And the interesting thing is that for Libelle, we know that development of the Pluto chip started approximately 96 or 97. So this gives us a time frame when these ciphers were created. The Chiasmus algorithm, it's not completely unreasonable that they designed their own. First, of course, you do not want your algorithms to be designed by the NSA, so it's logical that the government might not want to use a US algorithm standardized by the NSA. The first reference to Chiasmus for Windows, so one of the implementations, is October 2000. There might be earlier ones, but this is the earliest I found. And Rheindahl, which later became AES, was published in 98, so the public fundus of cryptographic algorithms wasn't that good at the time when this algorithm was designed, and it probably took them some time to design it. AES itself, the standard, was announced in 2001. For a rough comparison, GPG, the first version, was released in 1999. PGP was already 5 years old, approximately at that time, if I remember correctly. And the US crypto export restrictions, where cryptography was ammunition and you couldn't export more than 56 bits of cryptography, 40 bits in the even earlier time, these restrictions were lifted in January 2000, so it wasn't easy to get an official algorithm. So it's pretty reasonable that they designed their own algorithm at that time, and they did have the knowledge. Just to compare for the time frame, Wikipedia was founded in 2001, so this is really the dark ages. Here's what's for Windows, I already mentioned it shortly. It is a file encryption software, which was likely created completely in-house by the BSE. It uses the Chiasmus algorithm. The file format, you will find some encrypted files for it on the internet, but the file format is obfuscated, so it will be difficult to analyze without the software itself. They claim to use CBC, which seems probable from the files we analyzed. And it, according to the public documentation, it asks the user for additional randomness when you generate a key, like move your mouse in this window. So it probably is implemented in a way better way than what we analyzed. So the official Chiasmus for Windows encryption tool is probably not affected by the findings here, since these are implementation issues. The GS tool, on the other hand, is a software for management of IT baseline, of the IT baseline protection process, so how secure is your company, and stuff like that. And this was made by contractors. The contractors changed over time, and the main feature of this program is management of the IT security process, not file encryption, but it contains an encryption function to protect the databases which explain how vulnerable your company is. And this encryption function uses the Chiasmus algorithm, but can also encrypt any file, so some people may and actually do use it for generic file encryption. It's symmetric file encryption, so it's not like you can get the key of someone, you have a shared key on both ends, so it's a bit cumbersome. Chiasmus encryption is implemented first in GS tool 3.0, and according to the BSE, is unchanged, has not been changed since then, until the recent patch which fixed the issues. This 3.0 version was released in July 2003 and was developed by contractor Steria Mammert. I will not mention the name further because I don't think other contractors are especially better, but they are the ones who make these mistakes most likely. And the BSE made the mistake of not checking on them. There was a future version planned of the GS tool, which I think was 5.0, and that was supposed to be developed by Persicon. They failed very, very hard and very publicly, and the BSE first told them, no, we don't want this. Then they thought for a bit that they should have it redone, and then they gave up. So, to the actual point of this talk, the security issues with the implementation of Chiasmus in GS tool. Assuming you are implementing cryptography, someone gives you a secure algorithm, for example AES, what can you mess up? Does anyone have an idea? Just... Yes, but what? Give me some examples what you can mess up. Mode is a good idea. Another idea? Too complex. The really stupid things. Randomness, yes? Yes, key generation wikis. Yeah, that's one of the other things, but key generation, block cipher mode, and there's a third thing, integrity checking, because encryption does not equal integrity. And these are the main things you can mess up, and guess what they didn't mess up. So, for key generation, if you're generating cryptographic keys, these must be random. They should be unpredictable, because otherwise the attacker can guess them. Hello, Debian. And they should be long enough, because if the keys are too short, well, you can guess them. If you're generating keys, you need to use good randomness. That means on Linux and other Unix systems, you go for def random or def u random. It's a religious war I will not go further into. And if you need to use a pseudo-random number generator, use a good one. Usually you can rely on the implementation of def u random or some other generator specifically designed for crypto. So this is the way that ES2 does it. Spot the problem. Yes. This is not the origin code. We reverse engineered it. This is code that does the same thing that they do. First, they generate 104 bytes of key, which get discarded later, most of it. But the main issue is they are using srand of time and rand. First, rand is not a cryptographically secure random number generator, so you cannot use it for this purpose. Rand has 32 bits of state in the implementation used by the compiler they used. So this means you can guess the key with at most 32 bits of effort. It's seeded by a 32-bit number, so no matter how good the generator itself is, you only have 2 to the power of 32 seeds, which you have to try, so you can guess the key. And to make it even simpler, the key, the seed, is the time. So if you can guess the time, well, then you have the seed, and you have to guess even less. So in practice, the key space is smaller to 2 to the power of 32. I think everyone knows that 64 or 56-bit encryption like a DES is broken. So you can imagine how broken 2 to the power of 32 is. It takes approximately less than 1 hour to brute force it, I think, on a single core of a pretty old laptop. So we didn't bother to optimize it further. It is possible to optimize it further because not the entire state is used by the generator. We didn't look into it further because we didn't see the point. Felix, which did some of the parallel research, said in his talk that it was that he optimized the attack to 24 bits, which is even more instant, which is basically instant. If you know the time when the key was generated, you know the key. This means in practice attacks take a few minutes at most. And obviously, if you can get the key from an encrypted file, then the encryption is totally worthless. And it's dangerous, because people will encrypt stuff with it, and they will assume it's encrypted. So they will put it into their Dropbox, put it on their website for the contractor to download over non-secure HTTP, and stuff like this. So if you should ever be in the unfortunate situation that you have to do key generation yourself, do it properly, use defurandom or defrandom on Linux and Unix systems, or on Windows you can use cryptgenrandom, which is a Windows API available since Windows 95 or 98. We actually told them, okay, when you're fixing this, use this for key generation. The contractor then suggested or asked us if they can use a specific tutorial. It's linked in the slides. And the tutorial basically describes how to properly cast a time T structure returned by time for calling srand, so your compiler throws less warnings when you do the same insecure stuff they did before. After we specifically told them not to do this, and the tutorial itself mentions that you shouldn't use rand for anything serious. So yeah, pretty embarrassing, and I think it's not this single contractor, I think it's a general description of how contractors that supply ID stuff to governments work. Another issue that we discovered was block cipher mode. So these issues are bonus, because the encryption is already totally broken at this part, but if they fixed the first thing, these would become relevant. When you're encrypting data with a block cipher, the block cipher only encrypts 16 bytes, or whatever the block size is at the time. That means, you will, if you have something bigger than that, you will need to encrypt it in some intelligent way. ECB is the most simple block cipher mode. You simply take the first 16 byte, encrypt them, take the next 16 byte, encrypt them with the same key, and so on. This is a bad idea, because if you have the same plain text, you will obviously get the same cipher text. That means if you have a file with a lot of zeros, the attacker will be able to see which areas are completely full of zeros. The attacker can see which parts of the file are identical, and the attacker can also see if you encrypt the same file two times, then He sees, okay, these two files are identical. This may seem theoretical, so let's give it a more practical example. This is an image, it's a raw bitmap. I simply saved the bitmap as raw integers and encrypted it with a proper cipher mode, and then decoded it back as a bitmap. Can you guess what this image is? I assumed this answer and you're wrong. It's not this, I made the image myself. So, let's give you another chance. This is the same image encrypted with ECB. And this is actually encrypted data. I simply displayed it. So this is what you actually get if you encrypt something. There's no trickery, no nice visualization, this is raw data. You can see the issue, I guess, and you can probably guess that it's a CCC logo. So, yes, it is a serious problem. Of course, the entire block must be identical to get the same result. So if you look here, for example, I don't know how easy it is to see from the back, but you have a uniform pattern here in the totally white areas, you have a uniform pattern here in the totally black areas, but at the edges you have noise. So if you have a photo where every pixel contains a bit of noise, even if you encrypted it with ECB, the result would be pretty okay. The same goes for compressed data, because it's rare that two blocks are totally identical. However, if you have raw bitmaps with large solid areas, like in this example, it's vulnerable. And another example where it is vulnerable is databases. And that's what this system was designed to encrypt. So yeah, it's a problem. And it's a practical problem. If you have to implement this, you shouldn't. You should have a library that does it for you. But what is done is you use CVC, for example, which means you XOR the plaintext with a random value. At the beginning, you store this random value in plain. It's just to randomize the plaintext. And then you take the output of the first encryption of the first block here, which is random, and use it to randomize the next plaintext before encryption. For decryption, you first decrypt, and then you use the ciphertext which you have to XOR it, and then you get the actual plaintext. So this is how it's done correctly. Everyone does it except, well, people who mess up. Another thing is integrity checking. If you encrypt a file, you might assume that an attacker cannot change the file without you noticing, because it would decrypt the garbage. This is not true. This is not true even if you use CVC. People will think so, especially if they have no background in crypto, even some that do have a background in crypto, and people will rely on an encrypted file which correctly decrypts to be unchanged. You cannot rely on this. If you have an ECB encrypted files, the blocks are independent. You can simply swap the blocks, the file will decrypt, and the plaintext blocks will be swapped in the same way as you swap the ciphertext blocks. So again, this could be a problem. You could possibly even manipulate a database in a meaningful way. For CVC, you can truncate the file even at the beginning and the end. So you can cut out a bit of the file as long as it's aligned with the block boundaries. It will still correctly decrypt. So this could also lead to some attacks, which I will show in a moment. There's another type of cipher. We're talking about block ciphers here, which encrypt data block by block. There's stream ciphers, and there's a stream cipher-like operation mode for block ciphers. If you do this, you can even flip individual bits. That means if you flip the fifth bit in the plaintext, in the ciphertext, the fifth bit in the plaintext will be flipped. That means if you know the plaintext or parts of it, you can actually change it through the encryption. This was actually exploited in the wild with VEP, the wireless equivalent privacy in Wi-Fi, and this was one of the things that were broken with it. So a practical example of how you can break integrity of a file. You are the attacker and you want to make a file look authentic. I don't know how familiar you are with RAR archives. But the header in these is at the end. And RAR completely ignores any garbage in front of the archive. So if you take, for example, a JPEG, which is a length at the beginning, and append a RAR archive, then you have a hybrid file which is at the same time a valid JPEG that will correctly display in nearly any JPEG viewer, and a correct RAR file which will correctly extract, depending on what program you open it with. So now let's take the RAR file you want to send to the victim and make the, you have two people, one sender, one recipient, and you want to fool the recipient into believing that the file is actually coming from the victim sender. So you make the victim sender encrypt the file that looks harmless because it's your evil RAR, and behind that there's some decoy RAR that looks like the guy might want to forward it to the other guy, to the victim. They encrypt it, you obtain the ciphertext, you truncate it to cut off the decoy, and now you have an evil RAR encrypted with his key, which will decrypt correctly. Of course, you need to match a block boundary, but that simply means aligning it to 16 bytes. So, and then the victim will receive the file and think it actually came from the other guy he wanted to be talking about, but it's your file. You can not protect against this attack by simply appending a hash and encrypting it. This is what many people try, and it does not work, because you can truncate it exactly the same way. You put the evil file in there, you put the hash of the evil file in there, then you put the decoy, then the real hash gets appended and the entire thing encrypted. Well, now if you truncate it, you get the red part, which we have here. This red part, and that means that it will correctly decrypt, the hash will be there, it will appear to work, and it will be vulnerable. Again, if you have the screen ciphers, you can simply, if someone does the same thing, which they did in VAB, they actually did something even more stupid, but you calculate the original hash, you have the plaintext, so you know exactly what it's writing, you flip, you calculate what it should be, and then you flip the bits you need to flip, and that's it. So if you do encryption and do integrity checking, first use a library, do not do it yourself. But if you have to do it, what you do is you derive a separate key. That means you take the one key you have, you derive an encryption key, you derive an authentication key, and then you encrypt the file with, you encrypt the file with one thing, and then you run an HMAC with the second key over the entire thing. You should be careful because there's padding Oracle attacks and stuff like that, so do not do this yourself. Simply take a library that hopefully was made by people who know what they're doing. There's also authenticated cipher modes where the encryption is actually also the authentication, so you don't have to perform two cryptographic operations on the data. You can use those, of course, if you have them available. Another thing that the GS2 encryption lacked was any key file sanity checks. I'm not sure if they checked the length, so maybe you couldn't just use any random key, random file as a key, but I actually don't think they checked. So if you decrypt a file with the wrong key, well, it shows you that it decrypted the file and you get garbage. And then you wonder why you got garbage and you don't get any indication whatsoever what went wrong. This is not security critical, this is just a usability nightmare. But if you can use random files for encryption and somebody decides to accidentally encrypt the Word file with, I don't know, using itself as the key, then the attacker can guess the key because it's the header of the Word file, which is always the same, and decrypt the file. So there need to be some sanity checks on the key, and there are none. Or at least not reasonable ones. So to summarize the findings about the GS tool, this Grundschutz tool, which this database application, which has encryption as a side feature and is often used for file encryption in general. This encryption is totally broken in nearly every possible way. The only thing that is not totally broken is the cipher itself, despite it being a non-standard cipher, so this is actually pretty interesting. But we can recover the key and totally break the encryption with minimal effort. So this is totally broken. The Chiasmo software tool, the official file encryption software, is likely not affected by this because it's separate. I like to mention it multiple times because people often confuse this. So if you use the Chiasmo software tool, you're probably not affected too much by this. If you use the GS tool and have encrypted any files with it, congratulations, they're compromised. Now to the disclosure timeline. ETB was first discovered, this is the Insecure of Cypher mode, was first discovered by Christian Gresser, because it's really, really simple to see this. You simply look at an encrypted file, and if it has multiple blocks which are the same, it's ECB. And that's what he did. He published it in 2008. We found this during our research, and yeah, this is the first time something is very, very wrong with it. Felix Schuster wanted to analyze the tool, started doing it, contacted the BSE, hey, do you want my results? And they replied to him, if you analyze this, we'll send our lawyers after you. So he did research it, but he didn't tell them anything about the results, and he found basically the same things we did, which we only heard about later because he didn't publish it. He actually proceeded to use this vulnerable encryption as a challenge for a capture the flag contest, and it was solved. So this highly secure government encryption software is good enough for, well, a CTF challenge, so like a hacking. It might have been reported to the BSE by whoever solved it. I'm not sure about it. We don't know. In 2011, with approximately at the same time where the CTF happened, we were doing more analysis. We contacted the BSI, demonstrated the issue, told them, hey, send us a file. We want to test something. They sent us an encrypted file. Okay, here's the decrypted file. We need to talk. And they were very friendly at first. We described the exact issue, they made an advisory, you probably shouldn't use the encryption anymore, they announced that they will soon be releasing the service pack that fixes it. They only gave us anonymous credit, like some researchers from TU Darmstadt, and the advisory is hard to find today, it basically disappeared from the website. I would not say it's malice, I think they simply don't have their website under control, they reorganize it and lose stuff all the time. But well, many people didn't reach it, didn't notice the advisory. We communicated some more with them, gave them advice, some Simpsons comic, I should not use Rand, in reply to the suggestion by the vendor to correctly cast the time structure. And we provided the BSE with a draft of our paper where we described the algorithm we discovered, and they didn't like it. We received legal threats. To be specific, I'm translating it here. Thank you for the work you have put into further analysis. However, I must point out that reverse engineering BSE products constitutes a breach of copyright and will be prosecuted very strictly by our lawyers. I therefore urgently request that the document remains confidential. Can you please confirm that? So it was pretty clear that they basically do not publish it or we'll send the lawyers after it. They apologized a bit and diffused it in a later phone call when we researched the actual legal situation and said, okay, we think it's actually legal to publish it. Software is protected by copyright, 69C. However, 69D section 3 allows observing a program. Nobody knows what this means. So whether looking at it with a debugger is observing or not is unclear. And well, if they sue us, the federal court will probably in 10 years tell us whether it was legal or whether we go to jail for it. 69E also allows decompiling for interoperability purposes, but that puts some limitations on the stuff you gain, so it's unclear if you could publish it as open source, for example. Algorithms themselves are not copyrightable in Germany, which is explicitly noted in another section. And I would like to point out we did not reuse any original code. We didn't have it. We looked at the algorithm. We wrote it down on paper, actually, in only an algorithm description, and then we went on to implement it, so to make absolutely sure we do not accidentally use some of their code or some of the disassembly or something. So we went a very clean way to protect ourselves legally. We wasted a lot of time on the research. We did not get a definitive answer because there is none. They might still sue us. I don't think they will, but it sucks if people give you legal threats in response to helping. We delayed the publication to give them time to find a patch. We communicated some more with them, asked them several times, hey, do you want to like do something about it? It's been a year. And about 1.5 years later, they finally published a service pack, which fixes the issue. A month after that, there was a summer school talk in Bochum by Felix Schuster about the algorithm. You may want to see the slides of him. They go further in depth to the algorithm. We then, 2 months later, because we were quite lazy to do it, after 2 years I didn't manage to do it fast. We published an advisory and I sent them a Freedom of Information Act request for some further details, but I didn't get a response yet. It's perfectly okay, they're still within the time limit for that. So it's my fault that I sent it too late, but we might get some interesting answers. The fix was to simply disable the encryption button in the user interface. That's actually not too bad of a choice, because the encryption is broken, there's better encryption available today, so just disable it. However, the UI implementation is, it doesn't work. There's simply, the button is grayed out, no indication whatsoever why, and there's some small and pretty indistinct warning in the documentation, so some people might actually continue to use the old version because, well, in the new one the encryption is broken. So this sucks a bit. I've actually talked with some people who use this tool for file encryption, and this was like 1 year after the initial advisory, and they didn't have an idea on encrypted pretty sensitive stuff in it. They were hoping for this GS25, so I fixed the old one, it's going to be thrown out anyways. Well, GS25 is not going to happen, but they didn't know it at that time. We did think about whether we should publish this or not. Security and obscurity can be okay, so if they design a secure algorithm and want to keep it secret in addition to it, it will improve security. Okay, there will be less review, so there's less risk that, more risk that issues will stay undiscovered, but it will be more difficult to cryptonize it. So the idea to use non-published algorithms is not totally crazy, despite being very unpopular. But in the end, the bad guys like the NSA, they know about this. If you enter Chiasmus and then you find the GS tool sooner or later, you can download it, you can get the code, you will be able to get the algorithm, and reverse engineering is easy. The NSA can do it. So we are not accidentally disclosing some state secret that would endanger German state security or something. So we decided, no, it's not an issue to publish it, and we need to bring awareness to the users because the advisors were not very public. They had enough time to fix it. The progress was very slow. I think it would have been faster if we told them we'll publish very soon, and it's been 2 years since the initial advisory. Users were insufficiently notified, as I said. The advisory is hard to find, the patch notes are unclear, and the GS tool is used as a generic file encryption tool by people who really shouldn't use it for long. I will not say who, but yeah, it was a problem and they were really surprised when I told them, yeah, I broke this half a year ago and the BSC knows. The awareness about these issues was a bit lower in 2003, but not that low. CBC was invented 3 decades ago. So it is embarrassing, and especially embarrassing that the BSC did not do any review because they would have got it. Lessons learned. For publication, if you find a security issue, give them a hard deadline, preferably less than 1 year, and tell them, no matter what you do, release a patch or not, we don't care, at this time it will be published. I think, especially if the issue is as easy to fix as here, by disabling the encryption. I think this would have significant sped up the development of the fix. And I have a new personal policy, any legal threats of any kind, even if veiled or something, mean immediate publication. I don't bother anymore with it. They may go from the team. I will not waste several days to research whether it's legal covered or not. When it's published, they have less motivation to sue me because it will achieve nothing except the Streisand effect. Your mileage may vary, you may get sued, but it will probably save you a lot of hassle, especially if you go full disclosure from the beginning, because then they don't even get to make the threats. It's not nice. I will probably not do it everywhere, not even with the BSE, but yeah. So I don't have much time for the Chiasmus itself. You'll be able to see the slides, and it's probably boring for anyone who doesn't do crypto. It's a block cipher with 160-bit key size. In Chiasmus for Windows, they claim to use 128 bits plus a 32-bit checksum. The algorithm itself uses 160 bits. It gets expanded to 13 64-bit RAM keys in the key schedule, which explains why the GS2 was generating the 104 bytes. It was 104 bytes, but they are recreated by the key schedule, so it was pointless. Block size is 64 bits, it's optimized for 32-bit CPUs, and consists of 12 rounds plus one key addition. The round is pretty simple. they add the RUN keys here. Then you have a 1-byte SBox. The bytes get shuffled. And then you have something pretty unusual, a variable amount shift. So the shift amount depends here on the data, which makes the cipher interesting, so have fun analyzing it. There's a matrix multiplication in the middle. The constants are down here for encryption, for decryption. They're in some source code which we might or might not publish, but I guess the people who know crypto will be able to derive them. So this is a matrix, it looks like matrix multiplication. You know how matrices are multiplied. So basically, the two halves of the data block are the keys and matrix is constants. Then again, a variable shift, an S-box, which is inverse to the first one, and byte shuffling. The S-boxes are inverse. Here's one of them. I've highlighted one of the values, which is in position hexadecimal 1-3, and the value is hexadecimal 0F. So for the second S-box, we have in position hexadecimal 0F, it's again highlighted, 1-3. So how an S-box works is you take a byte, you have an array of 256 values, and if the byte is 15, then you take the position at the 15th position in the array. So if you put a byte for the first S-box and for the second S-box, it will be the same again because they are inverse. The key schedule operates on 32-bit integers. The first five integers are the original key. Then you, for the fifth and ongoing position, you take the integer five positions before that, right shift it or right rotate it by 7 bits. You take the integer three positions to the left, multiply it by constant, hexadecimal 3333333. You XOR the modes and that's the next key. So it's a pretty simple key schedule. And in the end, they add the position to the key integers except for the first five. So the fifth integer, the sixth integer gets incremented by six and so on. Security cipher looks reasonably secure. I cannot evaluate this myself, but Eric Staves had a quick cursory look. This doesn't mean it is secure, but it's not the usual snake oil you're used to see. We found a theoretical attack that reduces, if you take a five, if you reduce it to 5 rounds instead of 10 rounds, then you can break it with the complexity of 2^140 instead of 2^160. You'll find the same attacks against AES and any other cipher, so this is a purely theoretical and cryptanalytic result for cryptanalysis. It's not anything that indicates that this cipher would be weak. So, is this chiasmus? Probably. The cipher was obviously designed by the BSE because this contractor definitely didn't design anything that works in this way, because crypto is hard, I couldn't do it, and this contractor certainly couldn't do it. It's unlikely that the BSE did a separate cipher and named it chiasmus, but it could differ from the regular chiasmus. This possibility was explicitly mentioned in some documents about the data, that they could vary the algorithm. So for example, the constants, the S-boxes, the number of rounds, possibly even the key schedule could be modified. And since we know the contractor, we don't know who wrote the actual crypto code. I think it was the contractor, so it's always possible that they made some mistake that changed the algorithm without making it stop encrypting in a way that the file gets decrypted again. So we cannot be 100% sure, but it will be very similar to the actual algorithm. So to summarize, the chiasmus algorithm itself looks okay. It's no public, analyze it. The implementation in GS2 is totally broken. The BSE most likely didn't review it because it's really obvious, especially if you have the source code, even if you don't have the source code. And government IT contractors suck. I think that's a pretty generic term. There will be exceptions, but the general rule is they suck. And do not implement crypto yourself, not even by using an existing algorithm. Even if they used AES, they could have made exactly the same mistakes with exactly the same implications. The algorithm itself is okay, so do not do it. Use cyber libraries, and that's it. I have some questions to you before we go to the Q&A. If any of you know anyone who uses GS tool or have used it itself, do, if you know how the users were actually notified, if they got a notification, please tell me. If you have examples of users who relied on it and will be surprised by this talk, well, I would like to hear your interesting stories. Thank you for your attention, and let's go to the Q&A. At the end of the Q&A, I would like to make a personal announcement for one of my projects, so, yeah.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Jan. If you have any questions, could you please line up at the microphones? It's important that you use the microphones, because the streams are recorded, and before you line up, I could just ask, do we have any questions from the internet? Or Signal Angel, Crunch, do we have any questions from the IRC?
Not right now. No, nobody has any question at the moment.
Okay, then let's have microphone number one.
Hi, did I get this right? The analysis that you did of the algorithm is all from GAS tool, right? And not from this other, the Chiasmus tool that you mentioned? Okay.
Yes, that is correct. We do not have access to the Chiasmus tool, so we only had what was in the GAS tool to analyze. We cannot compare it to the other. The other tool is not public, you cannot even buy it without proving that you have some public interest in it.
Right.
It's pretty pointless that they try to keep the algorithm secret, but there might be some variations, so yeah.
Okay, so is this actually the first analysis of this algorithm?
As I said, there was another analysis by Felix Schuster. It was not as widely published. He had a talk about it in rather limited audience, but at the time where we did it, it was the first analysis we were aware of. There was this other one, but it wasn't published at the time.
Okay, microphone number four.
Eine ganz kurze Frage auf Deutsch. Weißt du, für welchen Verschlusssachen gerade die S-Tool verschlüsseln darf?
Also GS-Tool weiß ich gar nicht, ob es überhaupt Verschlusssachen verschlüsseln darf. Ich glaube, der Chiasmus,
darf VS-NFD, das weiß ich.
Ja.
Nur wenn GS-Tool auch VS-NFD darf, dann ist automatisch Chiasmus drin, weil nichts anderes zugelassen ist vom GS.
Ja gut, das könnte ja eine Variante, if it's a variant of Chiasmus, then it's a variant officially created by the BSI. So it could still be a slightly different algorithm and be certified for VSNFD, but I do not think it's certified for any VSNFD encryption. Doesn't mean it's not used for it.
Okay, microphone number one, please.
Given that you've described a situation in which a government department is encouraging people to use an algorithm that they know is broken and they're trying to suppress people saying that it's broken, what's the legal comeback on them from users who could sue them for, you know, pushing a tool that's not fit for purpose? Or do they have a disclaimer in GS tool saying, you know, we give no warranties with this at all? I mean, they're effectively encouraging people to use a product that's not only broken for them to see, like the NSA might, but that's easily breakable by anyone. With promises it's secure.
So they made an advisory that you should not use the encryption. I simply think it was not published widely enough. One of the things is I don't think they would have been too angry with us if we published, okay, it's broken. Maybe even if we told them, okay, it's broken in this and that way. What they really didn't like is that we plan to publish the Chiasmus algorithm description itself, which was also on the slides now. I think that's what really got them angry. Because until then they were friendly, and when they saw the algorithm description in the paper, that's when we got the email.
Okay, microphone number four, please.
Well, you mentioned that there's files that are supposedly encrypted with the official Chiasmus tool on the internet. Are they using the same file format as...
No, the Chiasmus for Windows file format is, as I said, obfuscated. It's a completely different file format. You can actually, Chiasmus, they use a very interesting licensing scheme, or DRM scheme. If you want to get an update for Chiasmus for Windows, you download the Chiasmus for Windows update, encrypted with Chiasmus. The key is public, but you simply need the software, because otherwise you cannot encrypt the update. And so we got some of these updates, and that was our ciphertext for analysis, but we made no progress.
Okay, so that's no help in verifying whether the two cipher implementations have anything in common.
No, it's too obfuscated to make any use, and there was also some leak of data stolen from, I think, Zollverwaltung or something, where some hacker group hacked them. They had Chiasmus encrypted files too, but I don't think there's any copies of that on the internet.
Thank you.
Okay, microphone number one, please.
So is the GSTool key stored on disk, and if so, does that key get protected by a password?
The Chiasmus keys are key files which are simply stored in the plain format without any wrapping, any protection, any anything. You have to store cryptographic keys somehow. You could protect them with the password, but no, that's not what they're doing.
Thanks.
Okay, in the meantime, any questions from the internet? No questions from the internet, then it's back to you.
Okay, then thank you for the attention. I hope the talk was good. It was my first talk on the conference. Small part of it here on the Congress, because there's a lot of people, so I could test it with more than 10 devices in the room. So if we could get 100 participants on this Congress using the tool at the same time, this would be great. It's a peer-to-peer tool, it creates peer-to-peer connections between the participating phones and collects data how well these connections work. There's a privacy policy in the App Store. You can get the program by entering P2P experiment in the App Store. If you have any questions, I'll be running around here at Congress, or email me or something. And this will provide research data for mobile peer-to-peer, which will be very valuable for censorship resistance. So if you please could participate, if you have an Android device with Android 2, 3, 6 or newer, please just download it, run it. You just need to run it for the time of the Congress. You can uninstall it after. But it would be really, really, really helpful if you could. Just make sure it can upload the files at the end, just give it Wi-Fi before you uninstall it. Thank you very much.
Thank you. That's a very final special permissions. This is require special permissions to run.
The application only requires the permissions that it actually needs, which is, I don't know them all from the top of my head, internet access for log upload, Bluetooth, obviously for the Bluetooth peer-to-peer communications. It does not collect location data. That's probably the most important thing. And obviously, it doesn't collect any serial numbers or stuff from your phones.
Okay, well, thank you very much. Thank you for this talk. On the way out, could you please take all the trash with you that you brought in so we have a clean room afterwards? Thank you very much. Goodbye.